RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So to the Environmental Defence Society's report, Restoring Nature, Reform of the Conservation Management System. We've invited Raewyn Peart, Policy Director at the EDS. Raewyn heads their environmental policy work and has over 30 years professional experience in environmental law and policy, having worked as a resource management lawyer and policy advisor to business, government and the not-for-profit sector. Bit about EDS, they seek to protect and restore Aotearoa New Zealand's outstanding landscapes, freshwater systems, oceans and Indigenous biodiversity through holding business and government to account, strengthening the law when it is found wanting, and supporting good environmental management practice. Raewyn, welcome to RCR. Thanks for coming on.
Great to be here, Paul.
Okay, to the title of the report, Restoring Nature, Reform of the Conservation Management System. What needs to be restored? How much needs to be restored? What lengths do we have to go to restore it? And then what reform is required? So let's start with the restoration first.
Sure. The reason we called the report Restoring Nature was, I think in the past, we've had an impression that Aotearoa New Zealand has a wealth of beautiful nature and we can afford to draw down on it, really, without paying too much attention to what's happening. And we've really reached a tipping point now where we've been doing that for so long that we've overreached, if you like, and a lot of our amazing Indigenous species are now really struggling, and there's 4,000 or more that are sort of on the brink of being threatened with extinction. So we really need to start thinking about how do we start building back that healthy Indigenous sort of systems, our forests, our birds, our other creatures. How do we start building that back so that we can actually continue to enjoy all those amazing creatures?
Yeah. Okay. So how on the edge? Because extinction is very final. How on the edge?
Well, we're very on the edge. And really, because we're facing climate change, which is likely to have catastrophic effects for a lot of our species, not to mention humans living in this country. And we've just seen those effects for cyclones and floods. But, you know, warming, increased invasive species. So a lot of, you know, as things get warmer, often it creates conditions where other introduced species can take better hold and are a bigger threat. It means that species, their habitats that they currently live in will no longer be, you know, places where they can thrive and survive, and they're going to have to move somewhere else. And we need to facilitate that. So I think what we're seeing now is the tip of the iceberg. And if we don't really get on top of things now, it's just going to get a lot worse.
Okay, you mentioned climate change. Not here to have a debate about that. But many of our listeners are skeptical about the climate emergency and the data that is being used and whether it's been caused by man and womankind or, you know, volcanoes going off in Tonga, all those arguments. But how sure are you regarding climate and the effect it will have on our Indigenous species that are endangered?
Well, I have to say, you know, we very much base our work on science. And so we look to find, you know, what is the best evidence that we have, and we build our work on that, irrespective of what's causing climate change. And in my view, you know, the science is pretty compelling in that sense that it's human-induced. But, you know, irrespective of the cause, the implications are very serious for both us and all the other creatures, you know. Also, just in terms of the costs of maintaining huts and tracks, and we've seen that impact, you know, we've just had that controversy over the Cathedral Cove access for tourism on Coromandel Peninsula and local businesses there crying out saying we need to reopen that track because, you know, that's the underpins our tourism industry here. So a lot of what happens on the conservation estate actually has very significant impacts for our economy and particularly our tourism economy, which obviously is a very large sector.
Do we have any idea how resilient, hear that word a lot these days, how resilient Indigenous species are? I mean, they've been here for a long time and presumably there have been all sorts of events over the millennia. Do we have any idea?
Yeah, well, a lot aren't here any longer, I have to say.
Okay. Well, because of us or just because of the natural ebb and flow?
Because of being hunted or loss of habitat. You know, how resilient are they? Well, you know, some are, but clearly a lot aren't. I mean, a lot of our birds, for instance, don't fly. Now, that doesn't make any sense in an evolutionary kind of context if there are predators on the ground, but there weren't when these birds evolved, and now they're being hammered by invasive species. And I just had a really interesting figure here. Introduced mammals cause over 26 million egg and chick losses annually. So
26 million
of our indigenous bird species are being killed every year by introduced species. I mean, this is very significant.
Let's get to the reform bit. What needs to be reformed? What can be done without, I guess, blocking off access at big scale to these areas?
Yes, well, I don't think anyone's talking about that. You know, the idea of having these wonderful, particularly conservation land, is that most of it is free, you know, widely available for the public and tourists coming to the country to enjoy, and, you know, hopefully that will continue. But the fact of the matter is that a third of our land is being managed by the Department of Conservation, grossly underfunded. You know, they just get a pittance, really. And then on top of that, they have this archaic and complicated sort of regulatory framework that they have to work within that needs to be sort of sorted out. Things like granting concessions to tourism and other activities on conservation land is incredibly complicated and long-winded and costly because of this morass of plans and poor legislation. So we're saying we just need to really cut to the chase, just sort that system out. We need a sort of clear directive, simple planning system that provides clear rules, you know, clearly sets out what we're trying to achieve, how we're going to do it, how we're going to enable use of conservation land, how we're going to encourage, you know, uses that are sort of going to support the conservation objective. So that's the first thing. The second thing is our Wildlife Act, and this may be of more interest to your listeners if they're hunters, for instance, or fishers. Yep. You know, dates to the 1950s, but that piece of legislation really dates to the 1800s in terms of its framing. It's not fit for purpose. It doesn't have any purpose in it. It has schedules of species, no differentiation between indigenous species or introduced, or between those that are threatened and actually need greater care. And so we're suggesting that needs to be completely sort of essentially kind of thrown out and replaced with something much more modern, and something that provides both for indigenous species and threatened species, that we give them priority because we need to look after those. Mm-hmm. But we also recognise valued introduced species. So those are the species that people would like to hunt or, you know, use for food, and that those need to be provided for, but in a way that doesn't endanger those threatened species. So that's being smart about how we manage and where we manage. And then we think we need to recognise taonga species that are of importance, value to Māori, and they also need to be looked after.
Okay, and what would they be? Just a curious
taonga
question.
Taonga species for Māori?
Yeah.
Well, I think they are both indigenous species. So in treaty settlements, a lot of tribes have kind of identified taonga species. You know, they might be bird species. They might even be, you know, pigs that have been hunted, you know, for, you know, generations since they were introduced into the country. So it depends on each tribe what species they kind of see as really important to them.
Okay. I was just expecting to hear indigenous species, not pigs.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I think, you know.
And I can understand how it could be.
Yeah, but different species are, you know, we have to accept, you know, we have more introduced species here than we do indigenous. And a lot of those are really important. They obviously underpin our agricultural economy. Mm.
So this is all possible from your view?
Absolutely possible. You know, we've been encouraging the government to get on with it, because it's really these poor legal frameworks that actually foment conflict. You know, if you've got fuzzy law and policies that don't really set out what you're trying to achieve, you know, it then becomes very difficult to manage. And I think that's where we've seen a lot of conflict over the management, say, of tar and deer and other species, because there hasn't been any clarity about, you know, how we're going to do it, where, and you know, things could be a lot easier.
What sort of conversations have you had with officials gauging an appetite to go this way?
Yes. Well, we've briefed DOC officials and we've also briefed Minister Potucker on our findings. And the minister was quite interested. He's very interested in raising more money, as it turns out, from the conservation estate. And he makes, I think, a really valid point that, you know, it's a third of the country. And the amount of money that DOC raises from use of that land is, you know, tiny. So we need to be smarter about charging, you know, concessions. So that's like tourism industry or grazing concessions, charging a fairer price for accessing what's essentially a public resource. We need to think about, charging international tourists. We've just seen the international visitor levy be raised, and that's a very positive thing because half that money is currently going into, you know, DOC's management. So, So I think the government's quite, you know, pretty interested in sorting out concessions, raising more money. And to do that, you need to simplify planning. The Wildlife Act's been on the government's agenda for, you know, quite a while.
A lot of our listeners will be thinking, ask her about this. So I'm going to. Should we be dropping things like 1080? I mean, talking about this now, big picture, and looking after our environment. And I get the arguments for using it. But there are arguments for not to. It's a very poisonous thing. Do we need to look at methods like that and maybe find other ways of controlling pests, maybe a more manual way? Because the two seem to be in absolute conflict to many.
Yeah. Well, I don't see it in conflict. I think we have to use all the tools at our disposal if we're going to get on top of the issue.
What if it's poisoning indigenous species, though, which many claim?
Well, the evidence I've seen is that the odd indigenous species might be affected, but overall the populations rebound enormously after you remove the predators. As I said, when you're talking about 26 million eggs and chicks being eaten, that's massive. If you can reduce that, I've seen when you go into communities where they've managed to remove the pests, they're delighted because they say, we've got birds in our garden. And for the first time, you know, we've seen these species come back. So brilliant. We need to use every tool. And, you know, we're now using AI, cameras, targeted traps. But I don't think we currently have enough tools in our toolbox to completely eradicate the use of 1080. So it's a matter of weighing up, you know, the benefits versus the risks. And the evidence I've seen is the benefits outweigh the risks currently.
Okay. Seems there's no specific route to looking at toxic chemicals in our soil or water anywhere in New Zealand legislation. Focuses on sediment, nutrients and bacteria, but industrial chemicals seem to be ignored. You got any idea why that might be or anything to say about that?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I don't know that they're ignored. And I've just been noticing in the media there's been discussion about the new Plymouth plant and the contamination of soil there, and some of that may have gone into the marine area, and I've heard suggestions maybe affected the Maoist dolphins. But, you know, certainly a really serious issue. You know, with agriculture, there's been concerns about toxins in the soil from artificial fertilisers, certainly from industrial uses. I think it's usually more site-specific, and maybe that's why it hasn't got so much attention, where things like sediment and nutrients are, you know, much wider. But no, sure, it's a very serious issue and it does need attention.
Also, there seems to have been quite a move in recent years to taking what are traditional farms, farmland, and planting in pine monoculture. And this seems to have a lot to do with offsetting carbon. And that, many people say, has an impact on biodiversity. Turpentine leaches into the soil from these pine trees. They're not indigenous. What do you think about that development of, I guess, the last 5 to 10 years?
I'm not a fan of planting exotic pine forests for carbon sequestration, particularly if they're permanent. I mean, the idea that we would just plaster pines all over our landscapes, I find quite shocking, really, and I hope it won't happen. But the current policy is incentivizing that because of the money that can be derived by carbon credits. So I don't think that's the right way forward. It's undermining, you know, rural communities, sort of sterilising the land for any other uses, not supporting significant biodiversity, nothing like an indigenous forest. And so I think we should be, you know, if we're going to actually plant, it should be with indigenous species that create rich habitats for our other species that need them. But, you know, we need to, you know, think about things, these things carefully, and I don't think pines are the answer.
Okay. COP16 in Colombia coming up, biodiversity conference. What would be the ideal outcome of that as far as EDS is concerned?
Yeah, I must say I'm not entirely up with international developments in biodiversity. We're very much kind of focused on what's happening mm-hmm. here, so the implementation of those commitments. But, you know, we're not doing that well, I must say, and that's why we're looking at saying, well, if we're not doing well, you know, could we fix the kind of legal and policy framework, make it clearer, sharper, more effective, more agile, so we can actually get on and do the right thing. And the other point I'd like to make is that there's enormous energy and support in communities, people out trapping pests, replanting, you know, riparian areas on rivers. There's enormous energy and interest in actually restoring this wonderful country, and we need to be supporting that, you know, scaling it up where we can, because I think as a nation, it will take a nation to turn this around, and so we need to be engaging everyone. So, you know, I think on the at the local level, there's enormous interest in this kind of thing.
And just one last question, other area that touches everyday people, let's say, environmental conservation and private property rights, you know, areas of significance to Māori, SNAs, coastal adaptation plans, that is quite controversial in some areas at the moment. Do you have any position on those items?
Yeah, well, I'll deal with that. They're quite kind of different things. So significant natural areas on private land. Most of our lowland areas have been privatised. We removed most of the Indigenous forest. Much of it's been farmed. We obviously have urban settlements. So if we are going to, you know, if our Indigenous biodiversity in those habitats is going to survive, we need to be protecting habitat on private land. That remains, which there is not a lot. But, you know, that could well be supported by support for landowners through some kind of biodiversity credit or payment, or, you know, I think it's fair enough that we look at working together, because that's a public benefit we're looking for. So let's support landowners to do the right thing. So I think, you know, there's a lot that could be done there. In terms of adaptation planning, I mean, people are facing losing their entire wealth through investing in properties, you know, their homes, that are now going to be subject to either serious flooding or coastal erosion where they'll fall into the sea. And this is an incredible big challenge that the country faces, and it will be devastating. And it already has been, you know, as we've seen from Cyclone Gabrielle and the floods to a lot of families. You know, so are we as a country going to kind of think about what we do about that in the future? There'll be many more affected. Do we actually bail people out, as the government's done in the current case? Do we move people? Do we allow new development in these hazard areas? Do we bail out the $2 million, you know, batch on the sea? So there's a lot of really tricky questions. And in fact, at EDS, we've done some work on this, and we're planning to do some more, because, you know, I think it's the biggest challenge the country faces, actually, is climate adaptation, the impact on our homes, and how we deal with that.
Okay, just back to, you mentioned biodiversity credits, and I was just thinking any system like that would have to at least match the potential capital gain lost from locking up someone's private property or limiting what they could do with it, right?
Well, I'm not sure that capital gain is lost. A lot of farmers covenant their land, you know, with QE2 covenants and the like, and I think have drawn the conclusion that increases the value of their property, and that, you know, it doesn't drop. And also, you know, farmers have said, well, when we actually fence off our gullies and replant them and keep cattle out, actually we're making more money. So I'm not sure that protecting these areas devalues land. I think, in fact, in many cases, it enhances the value. So, but sure, all that would need to be taken into account.
Raewyn Peart, who is the Policy Director of the Environmental Defence Society, thanks for coming on RCR and talking about your latest report, Restoring Nature, Reform of the Conservation Management System. And hopefully we can chat again. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. It was a pleasure.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.